Hello and welcome to the DMH Stallard podcast. I'm Adam Williams, and in this edition, we're focusing in on international trade and trading across borders. For those who trade internationally or those who are even looking to do so, we're going to go through a phase or are going through a phase of significant uncertainty and change at the moment, what the Chatham House Institute describes as re-globalization, as opposed to what some might have perceived as de-globalization. Driven by economies and governments, and then businesses as well, seeking to respond to the challenges we've faced since the pandemic. Those include things like inflation and high interest rates, debt distress, geopolitical frictions, and international conflict. So, what are the risks and opportunities faced by businesses trading globally or seeking to start trading globally in this new world order? With me to guide us through these issues are John Yates. John's a partner at DMH Stallard and group head of the commercial team, and he specializes in technology, commercial contracts, and intellectual property law. John's got a wide range of experience advising on all areas of commercial law and business matters, including cross-border issues, and has a focus on ensuring clients have in place robust contracts and terms, and I guess procedures and systems to ensure that they manage risk and increase value in the business that they do. And areas he gets involved in include terms of sale and business. And as I say, that includes import and export arrangements as well, in not just goods, but also data, of course. And I'm also delighted to introduce Martin Hamilton from Menzies, leading accountancy firm. Martin's a director and heads up the accounts team at Menzies LLP. And he's an international specialist and works with international businesses wanting to expand into the UK market and also UK businesses looking to expand overseas. So he's perfectly placed to give us insight on the structural and financial aspects of the topic we'll be covering today, not least because he gives an overall encompassing advisory support and services to his businesses, business clients. Particularly those who don't have the in-house experience to expand into new territories. And I know this firsthand because I've worked with Menzies and Martin in particular on projects myself. And of course, I've worked with John. So we're very well placed today to talk through these issues with our two guest speakers. So looking at the issues of international trade, trading across borders, financial and legal implications, then welcome, Martin, to the podcast.
Thank you, Adam. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us. If I could start with you then, how, if we're looking at a business that's trading in products rather than services for the moment, how important is it for businesses to have a clear handle on how they sell their products, how they go to market? Does it make a difference if they're selling through a particular channel or own website, online marketplace,
Yeah,
or
I
does it not much
mean.
matter?
Yeah, I mean it does. I mean there's just lots of considerations to have. I think actually for products and services, the own website, if you're trying to reach an overseas market is important. And there's considerations to ensure that you are effectively putting yourself in the best position to win the work. So when you're creating your own website, for example, you really want to be looking at areas such as localization, ensuring that the website has the right linguistic preferences for your target market. It translates content correctly, it provides currency conversions if you're selling goods, it adapts adapts images and product descriptions to resonate with local audiences, ensuring nothing gets lost in translation. So that's one of the main points. Kind of coupled with that is cultural sensitivity. We see that being mindful of the cultural nuances and sensitivities when marketing to international audiences, it is important. So you want to ensuring that you know which language to avoid using and which images may cause offense or misunderstanding in certain regions. So those are some fundamental basic points. More common points as customer support, if you are providing services or goods to overseas markets, having multilingual customer support to assist international customers is key. And of course, website performance. If it's being accessed from all over the world, ensuring the website loads quickly and has good functionality, is seamless across different devices and internet connections. You know, is imperative to ensure that you're putting yourself in the best possible light. Ultimately, all of those things kind of come together, and the takeaway is that if you're building your own website, you've got to look at the costs it takes to put that together and to maintain that from a business. Because again, doing business overseas, it comes with much more additional cost than it would do just be doing business in the UK. And these costs can be significant, and you know, you need to ensure that any ongoing costs of maintaining that website once built is factored into your future cash flows to ensure that your profitability and your margins are where you want to be when you're dealing with businesses overseas. So that's if you're kind of working on your own website. From a marketplace position, it's slightly different. You like to think, once you, if you're choosing a marketplace such as Amazon, for example, you know, they're going to be dealing a lot with those issues we just discussed. So it takes away that cost element, but it replaces it with fees. So if you're selling on online via marketplace, you're really focusing on profit margin a bit more. And really understanding the seller's fees on their website, and how they are calculated. They, you know, some of them can be hidden. It kind of the additional fees can be really hard to understand, and they tend to scale with the number of goods you sell. So it's quite hard to sometimes predict the fees on the website. So therefore, it's quite hard to understand your profit margin from month to month. Using Amazon, for example, or using an online marketplace.
Does that mean you have less control in theory over the costs and how they might increase later than if, even if it's at higher cost in a general sense than you would have with your own website? You've got more control over what you'd be charged. I'm assuming there's not loads and loads of providers to give you that marketplace positioning. Amazon, a few others, they control the cost going forward.
Amazon obviously are known for changing their costs quite regularly, and putting different costs in for the different services that they're providing. And the services they can provide are vast, and ensuring you know what you're signing up to, you know, when you're starting to use them, and you're not using, you know, you're not signing up services that you're not using. That's key. Other elements that Amazon do sometimes is if you're selling international, you know, when you're signing up, you go, they ask a question of, you know, do you want to sell in France and in Germany? And you go, yeah, of course I do. But then if you select that selection, they may, if you're not reading and making the correct selections carefully, they may move your goods overseas as well. And we'll touch on this a little bit later, but ultimately moving your goods overseas can create its own problems in terms of creating tax points overseas if your goods are already in that country when they're being sold. So there's risk there if you're using Amazon and you're not going in depth into the terms and conditions and on what the services you're asking them to provide you are. So you know, each comes with their own risk. I think ultimately Amazon may save you the cost on the website, but they've got their own fees which may be slightly hidden, and they may start moving your goods all around the globe, so you kind of lose a bit of control potentially with using them.
And picking up that point about control, and John coming to you, just on the issue of who controls how and where products can be sold across the globe, could you just give us an idea of through what methods do does does are decisions made about who's responsible for making sure that a given business's products can be sold in a given country?
Going to pick up on that point in a second, Adam. I just wanted to just I was just interested in listening to Martin just about own website versus Amazon and cost. And people really do underestimate the cost associated with setting up their own e-commerce platform. And it's perhaps not surprising, but one of the things that they do forget about is about data protection. And because you are collecting data about customers, and if you're selling into the EU, there will be a further cost in terms of data protection compliance, because you've got two sets of data protection laws to comply with. And there is a need for you to have somebody on the ground within the EU to pick up on data protection matters. So you need an EU representative. So it can be quite costly. The platform solution, Amazon Marketplace, obviously has been a great driver for many businesses. The one thing I think it takes away from is the fact that you don't get much actual brand exposure. You're just thrown in with a list of similar products. Yes, you can pay extra to have your own web store within Amazon, which is branded to a certain degree, but you do lose some of the kudos of having a brand, and you're not particularly selling on name.
Yeah.
It's typically on price. And
is it a means then, John, for businesses to test the market in some ways? They might say we plan for this, using the platform as a basis to take us only so far, as assuming they haven't got a concern that our brand is actually in other territories. You know, we might be undermining the brand.
Yeah. No, I think they use it as a means of as another sales channel. So you might find an established retailer or an established brand, they'll have their own e-commerce offering, and they will also use an Amazon Marketplace offering in tandem. I've seen that quite a lot.
Yeah.
Because it maximizes your storefronts. It's you know, instead of having 100 shops, you've got 500 shops. It's that kind of thing. There are pluses and minuses with both approaches. Go back to your original question, though, Adam, about.
Yeah, although before you do, just carrying that flow forward, it might not be easy to answer, but you know, how easy is it, relatively speaking, to adopt one of these models and then reverse out of it into the other? Whether if it's the platform solution, do you tend to be tied in for a long time? Is it hard to get out of that?
Well, from a legal perspective, I will confess I've not had any need to guide a client on Amazon Marketplace terms. I'd imagine there is a minimum term that you're committed to.
Yeah, I mean, from Amazon, there is, you do sign up for a specific term length, but ultimately it is fairly flexible. You'll find a lot of these marketplaces now are fairly flexible in terms of how long you stay a member for, and it's rolling monthly subscriptions. And ultimately, the marketplaces are really good for B2C channels, smaller businesses starting up, want to get their product out there, name out there potentially, and it's one would argue cost effective way of selling your products. And if you're looking at your more own website, you're looking at more larger B2B models, you know, larger businesses who have a reputation and are dealing with business to business transactions rather than business to consumer. So it's not always the case, but it's typically that's when you see your own website costs being more in place than the B2C costs.
Yeah, got you. Okay, great. John, we were going to talk about responsibility for making sure a product can be sold in a country.
So the starting point typically is that it's the person bringing the product into the market, so the importer is the one that is primarily on the hook. That said, it's not uncommon for a different position to be agreed in the contract. So whilst at law, the importer's on the hook, the contract might say responsibility for making sure that these products can be legally sold in the country rests with the supplier. It might be a UK business. So it's key to check what the contract says. Obviously, as a UK business, you're going to want to ensure that it all falls to the local guys. It's their country. They should know what's happening. They should know what's happening on the ground. The other thing to bear in mind is when you're putting products into a market, you've got to find out about the labelling requirements, what details need to be included on the packaging, that kind of stuff. Is there any requirements around languages? Typically, you might say, for example, if you're exporting to Scandinavia, group all the Scandinavian countries on one set of packaging labels, of packaging, So you might have a Norwegian version, an Icelandic version, Swedish version, Finnish version, but at least you can shift those products across those four countries easily. So you think about grouping, about logistics. That might
be consistent with what I've heard is this trend towards nearshoring post-pandemic as well, where you may be manufacturing the product more locally to that region, and so you're labeling them up with the languages of that region, and it's all happening from a sort of nearshore regional perspective.
Yeah, that will be driven by manufacturing costs to a certain extent, whether you're going to nearshore. Also, it can help with your kind of environmental footprint. If nearshoring is obviously preferable to long distance trade, so that they're, you know, you can see why you might nearshore. But from a practical point of view, if you're a UK business and you can divide up your markets easily, you can divide up your packaging easily. So typically you would put England and Irish packaging products together. You provide contact details for your Irish distributor, your UK distributor, and that will be one pack. Then you might have France, Belgium together on one as another pack. And that's the kind of approach you might take. But the key is what does the contract say? Because whilst you may wish that the importer is on the hook, you might find the contract says something different.
Yeah, and we would see things like indemnities, warranties, John, trying to shift the ultimate liability.
You'd see that. The other thing to think about is when you're putting, you've got the legal requirements, but also there's the position around your brand name. So a UK business might not have registered a trademark in Saudi Arabia, or it may not have registered a mark in Cyprus, wherever. You've got to bear in mind, registered trademarks are limited to a territory. So a UK trademark is not a valid trademark in Cyprus or in Saudi Arabia. You might find the importer wants you to go and get those trademarks registered if they're going to be sold under your name. And that they may want certain warranties in respect of that IP. As a supplier, you might say, well, we're not going to give any warranty as that is non-infringing, because we don't know what other products are in the market. So there's quite a few things to think about if you're taking products into a new country.
And local advice is going to be important if you're trying to understand the context in which you're having these negotiations.
We can perhaps pick up on that a bit later on. But yes, local advice is going to be key. Whatever happens, if you've got an English law agreement, it's not to say that foreign law might intervene. And we've seen it. We've done quite a bit of trade relationships in the Middle East. And whilst you might have an English law agreement, which is all tickety-boo, local law can intervene. So, for example, in many Middle East jurisdictions, if you've got a distributor or an agent, there's a requirement for that arrangement. There's a requirement for the agreement itself to be filed with a sort of trade ministry. And if you don't do that, you have great problems. You've got big problems when you want to enforce terms against the local distributor or importer.
But really good, important points to take away there, that you don't always trust that what you write down in an agreed wording will actually be the whole story in terms of what's enforceable later. We should come back to that point, John, as you say. Thank you, Martin. Thinking about probably the financial aspects of international trade and payments, presumably one of the things you focus on when you're working with businesses is the importance of having robust systems in place. We're thinking about sending goods, taking payments, and it probably feeds into the advice you give around taxes and duties on trade across borders.
It's a mindset to, again, once you've got your website in place, the next stage is to get your systems in place. So what you're trying to do is make the transaction with your customer as seamless as possible, but as also as transparent as possible. So you really want to ensure that if you're selling goods from the UK overseas, that that your customer knows what the full cost of that product is. And there's actually legislation coming in to ensure that when you click on an item tells you a price, that price now includes duty and delivery costs and soda. So you're seeing a full price when you're choosing to buy something, but that's not in place yet. But when you're selling overseas, you know, it's all about moving goods into that territory. Does that come with import duties and other sales taxes? And if it does, who pays those costs? And so ensuring that you've got suitable systems in place when your customer is on the website, that they can see when they get to the checkout box what the total cost is, and then they're not thinking, oh, what's that cost for, or even worse, that those costs aren't put on there, and when they receive the goods they've got to pay more costs to be able to take them home. And so having good reliable systems in place, you know, is important. And you know, if you're deciding to take on those delivery duties and taxes yourself to avoid your customer having to pay them, then that, again, you need to build that into your profit margins and your cash flows to ensure that that's another cost of dealing or trading internationally that you don't have in the UK.
And this is probably broadly, although there won't necessarily be the consumer protection driven rules that you said are coming in about how you spell out the costs, same broad principles and issues need to be addressed B2B, don't they, in terms of your point you made about need to be aware if there are duties to pay, delivery costs, so on, who's going to be responsible for them? You want that to be clear and understood, even in a B2B context.
Yeah, B2B is slightly different. I think B2C is vitally important. The buyer and seller, it's clear who's paying import duties and stuff, import duties and taxes. B2B is slightly different because B2B businesses are typically VAT registered, while individuals can't be. So if you're importing goods as a business and you've got to pay import VAT on those goods, then the likelihood is that you'll be able to reclaim that back. And the same will apply to European businesses as well. And whilst they may suffer the import duty, it's a typically reduced cost. It's a single percentage number rather than a high 20s or 25. So the import duty is maybe a cost of doing business for businesses, but they can typically get the import taxes back. So again, it's less of a problem B2B, more B2C.
Understood. Thank you.
Is it worth just picking up on Incoterms, Martin, as well, of what they might mean to a business at this point?
We've got Incoterms. I mean, Incoterms is a subject in itself. Should we touch on that a bit later? I could go on for hours talking about Incoterms, and I've got a couple of examples to share. So we can touch on that later. But Incoterms are relevant to see who does pay these taxes and who doesn't. And you know, it's clear for business to get them right. But we can touch on them in a second.
All right. Well, as we lead towards that, let's talk about probably one of the most important factors for any business doing anything, but certainly business looking to trade internationally. This point about getting paid, cash flow is king, obviously, particularly if you're a startup or you're breaking into new territory, it's going to be the lifeblood. John, to you on this, what are the additional risks around getting paid and therefore cash flow when you're trading across borders, and how can businesses try to ensure that they get paid?
Well, the big risk is you're not in the same place as the buyer. So there's a distance between you and the buyer.
Yeah.
And you need money to pass from the buyer to you for your goods. How are you going to get that to happen? Well, The easy one is the one that you said, cash is king. So getting paid up front is very attractive for an exporter, a UK exporter. For an overseas importer, it's the least attractive way of paying, of doing business. The simple reason is they're giving you money. They don't know if they're going to see the goods. They don't know what state those goods are going to arrive in. And they don't know if they're faulty. They don't know if you can back them up with a guarantee. So they're taking a huge risk.
Yeah.
So
we split it down the middle then, John. 50-50. We'll have half the money up front, half on delivery of quality goods.
Yes, that's one way of doing it. There are more sophisticated ways. And for many years, I think, you know, it's gone on for ages, was letters of credit were the way that these things were done. I'm not going to go on about letters of credit, but essentially it was a way that it was an arrangement which involved the importer's bank, your bank as the exporter, and it was tied to delivery of certain documentation would trigger payment moving from the importer's account to the exporter's account, and you get paid for the goods. And typically it will be tied into a bill of lading, so showing that the goods have been put onto a boat might be a trigger point for payment, or it might be a bill of unlading. But they're
pretty complicated.
Complicated. Yeah. They tie up cash, and the most common thing that we see is credit insurance. So you simply go to an insurer. There are several out there in the marketplace, and they will, for a premium, will guarantee that you get paid.
Yeah.
And it's a one-off cost. It's relatively cheap. It's less than a tenth of a percentage point typically in terms of value to a product. So, you know, it's a micro amount, and it
can be a bit of variation on that depending on territory or territories involved, John, or is it?
We've had. We've looked at credit insurance arrangements involving the US, Europe, the Middle East. It's not been a problem.
Yeah.
The key thing is the contract, making sure the contract supports what the insurer requires. So the insurance, you'll go to the insurer, they'll say your contract must provide X, Y, and Z. And you just need to make sure it delivers on that. It works well. Yeah. The other way is, of course, factoring, where you effectively sell your invoices to a factor, and they will collect, but they take a huge percentage.
Yeah. And your point being that cuts down the distance. They are in the territory.
Yeah.
They know the means and methods to extract the money. But you're saying it costs.
Factoring comes is. Cost, you know, typically 20% of the invoice value goes to a factor. So for every 100, you get 80. Whereas with credit insurance, for every 100, you'll get 99.9999 pounds. Yeah. You'll get nearly it all bar a penny.
Yeah. So it's hard to see how that would be the attractive option of factoring unless you're huge margins and you're happy to have 20% of it swallowed up.
Yeah, well, I've not seen it. It's unusual in an international trade context. As I say, credit insurance is so easy these days, and it is the kind of norm. And it compared to letters of credit, it's a lot less aggravation, and people, you know, as provided you can get the credit insurance in place, it works.
Excellent. Martin, should we talk about Inca terms now then in terms of
I think
their importance or not in your view?
they're vitally important. I think, you know, it certainly touches on what John said earlier in terms of contracts, ensuring everyone knows who is responsible for moving goods. And it certainly touches on the point we just made in terms of, you know, the transparency of your systems for your customers to ensure they know what the true cost of the goods are when they're buying them. Yeah. So Incoterms, effectively, you know, Incoterms, first of all, is short for International Commercial Terms. They provide a three-letter trade term that defines the terms of the trade and responsibilities and obligations for the buyers and sellers involved. They confirm the title of the goods when they transfer from the seller to the buyer, which is important to know whose responsibility is whose, when at any point where the goods are along that distribution channel. And I think the best way probably to explain it is to provide three kind of typical examples of Incoterms. And, you know, the list is quite long, but if I give you the three typical terms that I see used in the day-to-day, and I can just provide a good example for the listeners in terms of, you know, what Incoterms are and how they really work. So, you know, a good example, one of the first ones and the one typically at the top of the list is something called Ex Works, which the three-letter term is EXW. And effectively, this means that the responsibility as the seller of the goods ends at your own premises. It means that the buyer is responsible for coming to pick up the goods from your warehouse or your manufacturing plant, and then it's up to them in how they distribute the goods and move the goods around the UK. If they're picking them up from the UK, and if they've got to take them back overseas, then the goods are in their possession and they've got to deal with all the duties and the taxes in moving those goods overseas. So Ex Works is common, I would suggest, in larger businesses, business-to-business transactions, when you're moving large products around construction and bits and pieces like that, you'll see Ex Works we've built you this massive thing. Now you've got to arrange to move it and pay any taxes and bits and pieces if you're taking it overseas. So Ex Works is the first one. The second one is... Well, the second two really are more B2C transactions. But you see certainly more common with B2C transactions. You've got DAP, which is delivered at place, and DDP, which is deliver duty paid. Now, DAP means the seller is responsible for delivering the goods to the buyer, but the buyer is responsible for paying the import taxes and duties on those goods. And whilst DDP is, again, the seller was responsible for delivering the product, but the seller is also responsible for paying the taxes and the duties. Okay. So going back to my previous example, you know, or previous comments in the last section there, and on your website and being transparent about the costs, is that if you are selling the goods and you're not taking on the burden of the overseas import taxes and duties, then you're selling it DAP, and you've got to make that clear on your website to avoid any nasty surprises for your customers, effectively, and protect your reputation a little bit. You don't want your customers buying a product of you and then they've got to pay more money to receive it, which they weren't aware of, and then that could have some negative feedback on social media and whatnot. But also, if you choose to sell DDP, it means you're taking the full cost on board, and when your customer receives the product overseas, they don't have to pay anything and they can just take it from the postman at the door. But again, you've got to build those costs into your margin and to ensure that you're remaining profitable and your admin, you know, and your admin costs don't eat away all your gross profit, effectively. So ensuring which Incoterm to use is very important. You know, it impacts the margins, cash flow, and possibly reputation.
And really, just throw in really an item from history.
Yep.
Tied to DDP. So in a land long ago, there was a thing called Brexit that happened.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Prior to Brexit, it was quite funny. People hadn't really looked at their contracts, and we saw a number of supply agreements where people have been selling into the EU and they have been doing on a DDP basis, delivered duty paid. Yeah. Now, of course, that made pre-Brexit, that was of no importance because there was no duty paid.
Yeah.
But post-Brexit, those contracts came with a special cost because now the supplier had to bear the duty. So we did a fair bit of work around trying
VAT comes into that as well, because you could reverse charge it before Brexit. Yeah. You can't post. You're not in the same jurisdiction anymore. So you know, duty and taxes are really massively important now, and it really has to be factored into everyone's margin.
Well, let's pick up tax quick. I'm going to fire a quick question at each of you, and then we'll close with your takeaway for the listeners on this session. But Martin, tax then. Let's just pick up on that. For a lot of businesses, that's going to be the fairly daunting aspect when they're looking overseas. Have you got any tips or questions businesses should be asking themselves in order to get a clear picture of what their exposure and what the issues might be?
Well, speak to an advisor first and foremost. Is the main tip to be able to run through your strategy to ensure that you know your tax risk is minimal as possible. But ultimately, things to consider for the listener is, you know, if you're selling overseas, you know, think about the things we've previously discussed from an indirect tax perspective, which is sales tax, VAT, and whatnot. But however, if you're effectively selling overseas a service or goods, even you do need to think about the direct taxes such as corporation tax, and effectively these come into play if you've got boots on the ground overseas, or if you've got an office overseas, you've got a self-contained warehouse overseas, you've got to be considering whether or not you're making a permanent establishment in that country, and therefore understanding the rules and regulations for that in the country in which you potentially could be operating in, and therefore have a tax liability for the profit that is generated from the operation in that country is key. And every country in the world will have typically different rules and regulations about permanent establishment. You know, ultimately, 6 months is a good rule in terms of you can go over there to perform a service for a couple of weeks, you're not going to create a permanent establishment. But if you're there operating permanently for 6 months or so, is a loose rule of thumb in terms of actually, I might be creating a permanent establishment here. Do I have a local tax requirement to add to my home tax requirement? And do I need to understand how that works? So yeah, if you're starting to move people overseas or own assets overseas, that is certainly a consideration in addition to the international duties and sales taxes previously mentioned.
Yeah, very useful. Understand your thresholds and your trigger points in given territories. You and I have seen that. I've seen you looking at that with businesses we've worked on projects before. What are the thresholds, and are you comfortable with what they will mean in terms of liabilities for you if you do move through your past?
I mean, exactly that. And, you know, with the global mobility, you know, post-Brexit, and everyone seems to be working from home, but home could be in Brazil or home could be in Portugal. Well, actually, it might be, but it all depends on what work you're doing and what the rules and regulations for permanent establishments are in the country in which you're doing work, and whether or not you hold an important enough role to create an operation or permanent establishment in that country for your employer, and therefore do they have a tax requirement to consider in that country that you're working in. So it's permanent establishment is a key aspect of trading internationally if you're moving people around the world.
That's really helpful. John, I'm not going to give you the challenge of summing up how you can or cannot control what law will apply to a given set of sales. I think that's a session in itself. This, local agent and distributors, this is an interesting point. You know, business might be looking at using a local agent or distributor to get its products to consumers. And then there's maybe a perception that's simpler. But is it really always simpler? Are there any issues they need to be thinking about? Well, I'm sure there are several.
But yes, typically, if we talk about goods, if we're talking about exporting widgets or whatever, rather than services, it is it's usually preferable to use a distributor, so rather than an agent. The difference being is that the distributor will sell those products on in its own name. An agent effectively is just that, acting as your agent and selling on your behalf.
Yes.
The reason why it's it can create problems, and it's, I'm going to come back to distributors in a minute, but if you just keep it simple, within the EU and in the UK, there is a set of regulations. They're of a common origin, the commercial agents regulations. And they are fundamentally the same across the UK and the EU. And they provide, where an agent is negotiating or concluding sales of goods on behalf of a principal, that person is entitled to certain rights. So there are certain provisions that must be in their contract. But the most costly is there must be provision for some form of payment. And I'm being deliberately vague about the form of payment. It
depends which territory you're in.
But there is the idea of a compensation payment or an indemnity payment when the contract comes to the end. The principal being, and that's principal spelled P-L-E at the end rather than A-L, the principle is that an agent is seen to add value to the principal's business and therefore should be rewarded for that, the goodwill it's added, when the relationship comes to an end. So on paper, looks like slam dunk, let's go with the distributor. Two problems. One, it's not the same across the world, and in many jurisdictions, distributors are entitled to compensation too. So, for example, in the Middle East, a distributor is entitled to compensation on an agreement coming to an end in certain countries. And the other thing is that typically you've got more control with an agent, so you know what they're doing, and you don't have that degree of control with a distributor. So it's not.
At one point, we should make, John, I guess, because listeners might be thinking about it. Certainly as regards the commercial agents regs, it's not something you can be just cleverly contracting out of and saying, by the way, we both agree that won't apply.
No, it doesn't
work, does it? You and I both know from experience. So it's not one to just shut your eyes to or try and draft your way out.
And the key from an English law, if you're reporting an agent in the UK, is to make sure you understand the basis of that payment at the end of the contract.
Yes.
It is vital that you spell out the nature of that payment. So yes,
very good.
The one thing I was going to just bring us back to, just in terms of where we started, was we started talking about technology and about websites, and just to say, don't forget how much technology can help us do business overseas. So you're seeing now things like AI platforms that will help you optimize the sales process. We're all familiar with, the logistics, the QR codes that we see on packages and everything. They all feed into tracking systems, making it easy to show where products are at any one stage in the supply chain. You can apply that to parts if you're a manufacturer. You can use QR coding. So, it's just funny how we can technology encompasses all of this, from the means of sale to how we actually manufacture the products in the first place.
Well, you've done brilliantly there, John, because you've got in advance of me asking you. I think that's a perfect takeaway of, if there's one other thing now in the modern global trade context, what would you give us a tip for listeners to think about in terms of opportunities? Things they can do to make the best of their efforts. Hopefully you haven't stolen Martin's, because I'm going to ask Martin to give us his example, and hopefully he won't say it's the same thing. But Martin, as we wrap up, and thank you both very much, it's been really insightful. Can you give us a takeaway you would give to a business who's either going into a new territory or trading internationally for the first time, something they should think about and take away?
Yeah, it's research, really. You know, having an international business plan in place, doing the right research, making sure you're going to the right region, making sure there's a demand for your products there, understand how you're going to sell that product there, what costs, who's going to get the goods over there, whether or not you're going to have your own company over there, what does that group structure look like, whether you're going to be using a distributor or an agent. Just doing the necessary planning behind it, and costing forecasting before you press the button. You should really be thinking about doing it about a year before you actually do it, or at least 9 months, and making sure that, we're ready, we're good to go. You know, we've got all the legals, we've got the accounting, we've got the research done, we know exactly how we're trading, what it's going to cost, and that it's going to be profitable. You're not doing it on a whim.
There you go. Fantastic. Don't learn as you go and just sort of get stuck in and send someone over for a year and think about what the implications are later. Plan ahead, and you'll avoid some possibly nasty surprises along the way. But both, thank you very much. That's been really interesting. For all the listeners, if you haven't already, do sign up to our DMH Style Hub podcast. You can get details on the website and on LinkedIn. And look forward to having you all join us on our next episode. Thanks, John. Thanks, Martin.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you, Adam.